This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We are going to visit with Renee Chatelaine of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. She heads this August group, and we'll be talking about the state of the arts in Louisiana. Are we comparable to other states, and is Baton Rouge comparable to other cities? Also slated to opine on this subject is Victor Goins, the acclaimed musician from New Orleans. And we'll hear from guests from the Pennington Center regarding a study related to obesity and African Americans, a major study that the Pennington Center is embarking upon. And also, does obesity have a risk related to Alzheimer's disease? And Catherine Gerbner, an accomplished historian with her book about Christian slavery, a controversial topic, and we'll delve into it. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is producing, and hope you had a great weekend. Glad you're spending time listening to 89.3. And in studio to begin is Renee Chatelaine, the president and CEO of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. And in just a bit, we'll hear from a gentleman from the Pennington Center about the risks of Alzheimer's and African Americans in particular. Robert Newton Jr., Dr. Robert Newton Jr. will be with us. And later, a historian of note, Catherine Gerbner, on her book about Christian slavery. Renee Chatelaine will be joined in short order as well by Victor Goins, the acclaimed musician who is a professor of note at Northwestern in Chicago, Evanston, Illinois, great saxophone and clarinet player, and they're here to talk about the state of the arts in Louisiana. And not a coincidence, there is an arts summit coming this way, as in tomorrow, right here in Baton Rouge. And Renee, always a pleasure to share the microphone with you.
As with you, Jim.
Well, you were inspired to, recently by a canvas trip that these city leaders take every year. This one was to Cincinnati. How do we compare with a place like Cincinnati? Much larger city, of course, but still, is there more influence, more emphasis on the arts there than there is here?
You know, not only is there more emphasis on the arts, there really is more support and backing for the arts. And I think that we here in this city have a wealth of very high quality artists, both performing and visual. And what we are missing is business and industry support of those different arts and the whole art sector so that we can create a vibrant community. You know, it's not just the intrinsic value of the arts, but, you know, it's the arts that make a city successful, investing in the economic development strategy, putting them in there.
And we've seen arts funding go down in recent vintage. You know, people may be under the impression, for example, that WRKF receives money from the state of Louisiana. It does not. The LPB does, but not WRKF, and not any public radio station in Louisiana. Very little funding from the federal government, but there's this perception that these entities, and it's not just WRKF and public radio, but other arts entities are swimming with public money. Is that perception accurate?
I don't know if people think they're swimming in public money, but definitely think that the only obligation to support arts is through public money, and that's a farce. And, you know, with especially with WLPB, too, there's always a struggle to maintain the state funding, and, you know, we should be supporting those types of entities and definitely the artists. And other cities who've recognized that and have corporate support and private support of their arts sector are the ones that are doing very, very well and really thriving and growing and becoming enticing places to live and work.
877-217-5757 is your number. In Baton Rouge, 297-5633, and you can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Renee Chatelaine, the last 3 years, president and CEO of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Prior to that, she led another entity of note involving the arts, the Manship Theater, for 5 years. And Victor Goins, a great performer from the fine city of New Orleans, is with us. He's en route to the airport right now, but he's been a member of the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, and, of course, he and Wynton Marsalis and the Marsalis brothers go back a very long way, and I mentioned that Victor is also director of jazz studies and professor at the School of Music at Northwestern in Evanston, Illinois. Victor Goins, what's your take on how much we treasure the arts in a tangible way in Louisiana and where you're located in New Orleans?
Well, good morning, first of all. It's a pleasure to be with you all. I couldn't agree with Renee more. The challenge is when people do not support the arts, they omit the most important element of what makes people human. So the South in Louisiana has great talent in it. It's easy to see if you just look at all the musicians that come from New Orleans and Baton Rouge, Troy Davis, the influence of Alvin Baptiste or Wes Anderson and so many other great musicians, Harry Anderson. But yet still, we're really struggling down here because we need that support to happen at a very, very early age for kids, the elementary and the middle schools. And unfortunately, as soon as budgets get taxed, the first thing people cut are the arts. And we really need that support.
Well, is there a way to generate public support? We talk about things. You hear that during pledge drives with regularity. Why is the support in some quarters gone down, Renee? Do you have an explanation?
Well, I think looking at how to support the arts is certainly something that this city could focus on. And entities like the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, who look at research and development in economic development and industry, should include the arts, you know, in that conversation, because when you don't look at it as giving to a charity, when you're looking at it as investment into an economic future that is going to be thriving, how you increase visibility with your entertainment and tourism, how you increase arts education, as Victor cited, all of that has to go together. And so it's really an investment in the future, not so much charitable giving. And so people are moving to play, they're more and more mobile, and they're moving to places that really can serve their families and their quality of life quotient, as well as their business development. And so the creative capital is important.
Well, this brings us to the Arts Summit, which starts tomorrow, a three-day affair right here in Baton Rouge. And Victor Goins, who's with us by telephone, will be the keynote speaker tomorrow night as the session opens at the Capitol Park Museum. Tell us about what happens. Let's start with Tuesday. Renee Chatelaine, you've got an opening reception, and I'm sure it'll be quite an affair at the Capitol Park Museum.
Yeah, so we're really excited that this is an art summit that is statewide. So we'll have arts organizations, individual artists, leaders in the industry, and also business leaders, economic leaders, government, and education coming together to talk about ways to improve our state and our city. And so it opens with a really exciting reception. That reception is at the Capitol Park Museum and, of course, is open to everyone. You don't have to be a professional artist to attend. And we will see a really wonderful site-specific performance with Basin Arts Collective out of Lafayette. And then Victor Goins will be our keynote speaker. And so we're very excited about that, and we want the general public to come out and support these great groups.
All right, and then Wednesday you start early, and this one is at the Main Library, 7711 Goodwood Boulevard, full day of activity.
Absolutely. This is the statewide portion of the summit. It will be opened by First Lady Donna Edwards, and also we'll have the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, who will help foster in a session. They have a really incredible educational website. We have regional arts councils from throughout the state coming in to facilitate and speak at this all-day-long summit, and we invite everyone across the state to participate. Day three is led by Mayor Sharon Westenbroom, and part of her State of the City Parish address in January cited an arts summit. So this is it. And this is when we will look at city issues and creatively make some pitches to the mayor about how to solve them creatively.
All right. And day three is at the Baton Rouge Community College.
Correct.
And that'll start at 8:30. The Wednesday, day two event starts at 8 o'clock, but it runs 3 days, and it'll start tomorrow night with Victor Goins, the great musician from New Orleans, who will be front and center. Michael on Florida Boulevard. Michael, good morning. You're on the air. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning, Jim, and thanks for taking my call. This question is for Renee Shell. And hello, Renee. We obviously know the long-term goal as far as the summit is concerned, to create an awareness of the arts and get support. What are some of the short-term goals for the summit? Thank you, and I'll take the answer offline.
Thank you, Michael.
Great question. Thanks, Michael. And the short-term goals would be to bring different arts organization and individual artists together so that they can network and perhaps begin a collaborative process. This is something that would be really a recipe for success in our city and our state. And then also to have artists be introduced to some of the business leaders so that we can collectively continue this conversation beyond this three-day summit.
877-217-5757. We'll spend some more time with Renee Chatelain. We're going to let Victor Goins catch his plane, but I think he is still with us as he is about to, if he's not already there, at Louis Armstrong Airport. Victor Goins, what will you stress tomorrow night in your opening address?
Well, first of all, I'm not catching a plane. I'm coming to Baton Rouge, so I'm going to be there on time and early, ready to be a part of the summit. But I think the importance, as Renee had mentioned, was that we have to not look at the arts like it's something extra or something that is not needed. It's a necessity. It's the charitable aspect of it is not as accurate as it needs to be. We really have to realize how much it is a part of our daily lives, how much it makes our kids better, how much it makes us better people along the way. So I just want to really support the idea of what Renee is trying to inform people of.
Well, we'll let you get to where you're going. I know you're at the airport, but Victor Goins will be here in Baton Rouge tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Capitol Park Museum. We'll talk more with Renee Chatelain about what's going on in the arts world. And again, 877-217-5757 is your number. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. The incomparable Renee Chatelain, lawyer, dancer, and chief executive officer of the Baton Rouge Area Arts Council. And she will be front and center tomorrow night and for 3 days with the Arts Summit here in Baton Rouge, which is a statewide affair. It starts with Victor Goins, who we just heard from, tomorrow night at the Capitol Park Museum, 6 o'clock. And then there are events throughout the day on Wednesday and Thursday, Wednesday at the main library and Thursday at the Baton Rouge Community College. And for those who wish to participate, Renee, how do they do so?
So you can participate by the day. It's $25 a day. That includes a breakfast, a lunch, in the case of the reception, of course, hors d'oeuvres, libations, and really incredible quality performance by Basin Arts Dance Arts Collective. So you can do that, or you can pay $50 for all 3 days, a real bargain. If you are a member of the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge, it is free for you. And the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities has provided some funding for travel for those people coming in from other parishes and if they choose to spend the night. So they just need to contact us if they have, an interest and would like more information.
How does one become a member of the Arts Council?
You can just go to our website at www.artsbr.org, or you can call us at 225-344-8558.
Well, you managed the Manship Theater for 5 years, and that is a spectacular arena. And I know many artists love performing there, but with 325 seats, it creates a bit of a challenge. And you overcame that to a large degree, getting some major entertainers there, and there's still some, in fact, one this week in Paula Cole. But how difficult is it? Like, for example, if there were a 3,000-seat arena, I suspect it would be a much different situation here in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, I think, you know, it was interesting because when I first took on the job at Manship Theater, the challenge was that it was only 325 seats. And I said, you know what, that is really the jewel of it, is that there are only 325 seats. So if you really turn that around and say, this is a very exclusive, beautiful space, then it becomes somewhat of an appealing, intimate space where you can see these artists up front and personal.
And some extremely memorable performances there.
Absolutely, and I was just honored to have a tenure there to be able to meet some of these artists and really sit in the audience just like some of the other people in Baton Rouge and enjoy the incredible mm-hmm. performing.
Now, Molly Buckman from the Baton Rouge Ballet Theater was here Friday, and she is one who's been battling this year after year after year. And now, with the River Center being worked upon, that changes the environment for a group like the Baton Rouge Ballet Theatre, doesn't it?
Right. I mean, it's really important that we have a strong ballet company that is supported, as well as an opera company and symphony as well. And they require larger spaces than the Manship Theater can accommodate. And so the River Center is really vital to that. And I'm glad to see that we are going to be beginning renovations here on that center. And in the meantime, we'll be looking at some creative ways to showcase those very important groups in our community at other venues, but the River Center, when finished, will be an incredibly beautiful, updated space.
A listener here, Kyle, in Mid-City, mentions your tenure with the dance group, the Mid-City dance group that you were involved with for many years. He says he misses those performances.
Oh, how wonderful. It's Mid-City Dance Project. And yeah, that we performed for 18 years here in the Baton Rouge community. And what I'd like to say to Kyle is, you know, it was a really wonderful family. And now a lot of those children are grown up and they're all over the world doing incredible work. And I just returned from India, where a similar program was started by one of my students there. And it's pretty incredible to see.
That was largely a group of underprivileged kids, too.
Right. Underserved and special needs children, we wanted to give everybody the opportunity to be a dancer.
All right. Here's another note from Kristen, not Kirsten, Kristen, saying that the arts sometimes are regarded as being a hoity-toity, upper-class, snooty endeavor. How do you get past that perception?
Well, you go to performances. And I think you will see that that is really a misguided perception, that especially in today's world, there's never been more access to quality art of all levels. And, you know, I know that the Baton Rouge Symphony has in its programming for this year and the coming years to be very community accessible. The opera certainly is very community accessible, as is the ballet. They are constantly in the community. So go see a show, and I think you'll find it very welcoming.
We've always had one of the best symphonies in the country, but going to these performances, and I suspect it's true around the country, there are a lot of white hair. There is a lot of white hair, a lot of bald heads for guys of my vintage. It's an older crowd. How do we get young people immersed in the arts?
Well, I think challenging our arts community, and that's what's so important about this summit, is not only to have the public find out more about the artists and their real great work in the community, but for artists to be relevant, to be current, to be in touch with the community that they are serving.
In some of the areas, particularly on Tuesday on Wednesday and Thursday, you have a session called Arts Education from A to Z. What's this about?
So there's arts integration techniques for teachers. And in fact, I'm glad you mentioned that, because EBR school teachers who attend this session will be given professional credit for our continuing education credit. And so we encourage those teachers to attend. So even if you're a science teacher, there are ways to put arts into your science curriculum, and that's arts integration. And these are the kind of tools that we'll be giving. And First Lady Donna Edwards has been a real champion of arts education, music especially, in the schools. And so that's important, arts itself and arts in the other core subjects.
And at 9:45 on Wednesday at the Main Library, one Renee Chatelaine will be heading a panel, Planet, Live It, Assess, Repeat. What's this about?
So this is to give arts organizations and individual artists a real planning strategy, so that if they have this really incredible idea, which so many of them do, that they have the right tools to give themselves the right amount of time and the right amount of funding and realistic expectations, as well as relevance in the community.
And then there's something called Engaging Your Whole Community, and you have an array of speakers for this one.
Yes. There are a variety of speakers throughout the day. So some of the sessions throughout the day may involve insurance for artists, and, you know, what are some of the tax consequences, especially what have been some of the changes in the tax law regarding charitable organizations and philanthropy. And so how do you troubleshoot? If you're an arts market artist, how do you get your brand out there? If you are an individual artist, what is an artist statement, and how do you get in a gallery? It's some real practical tools for actually doing business as an artist, because we want those people to stay in our community, whether it's statewide or here in our local community, we want them to be doing work. Louisiana has the richest cultural identity in the nation, and we don't want that to be exported, right? We want it here.
And another session, being social where you are.
Yeah, that's a really, really great session. I think it's Courtney Scott that's leading that one, and it's all about, I guess, 101 to expert level of Facebook, social media, how to get your word out there, and how to be effective in interactive social media campaigns.
And on Thursday, the final day, one about grant writing, presentations, and pitch coaching, and then President Sharon Weston Broom will be the one who closes the session on Thursday, and this is at the Baton Rouge Community College. So it's a big event, and once again, Renee, for those who wish to be there, the best way to make preparations now is?
Best way is to register through artsbr.org, and I would say especially that day three, if you are in the city parish of East Baton Rouge, then it's really important to come because the mayor will be really listening to those pitches. Think of Shark Tank. You know, there may be a pitch that we will adopt and that will be funded.
I like that, yeah. And, of course, Sharon Weston Broom worked in the media for many years, and Renee was a performer and a director and now is leading the Arts Council. And we had her on a few weeks ago with her husband, Kevin Lyle, who's now the toast of Broadway. So congratulations on what's happening in your world, and hopefully we can stimulate more interest right here in Baton Rouge and in Louisiana.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Renee Chatelaine, keep up the good work. And we'll return after this pause. Your Talk Louisiana number is 877-217-5757. Now the news with Karen Henderson on WRKN. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana. Becca Dill is producing, and Dr. Robert Newton is with us, PhD from the University of Florida, B.A. Hampton University, and a native of Poughkeepsie, New York. But he's been in Baton Rouge for the last 17 years, one of the longest-serving professors at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center, noted nationally and internationally for its work. And there is a major study that the Pennington Center has embarked upon, and it's tailored to African-American adults. And Dr. Robert Newton, tell us what's going on.
Yeah, so the PACE study is what we're doing, and really what we're trying to do is we're trying to determine if one of two different programs will reduce risk factors for developing Alzheimer's in African-American adults. And one of the main reasons why we're doing this study is that, you know, as you know, our population is aging, Alzheimer's is, and other dementias are increasing, and African-Americans are understudied in this area, and they have a high risk of developing Alzheimer's. And so,
is there a significantly higher risk among African-Americans?
Yeah, so African-Americans are actually two times as likely to develop Alzheimer's.
Twice
as likely to develop Alzheimer's, yes.
And, of course, African-Americans in this country have a much shorter lifespan than do white Americans.
Yes, that's true. And there's a number of different factors that contribute to this, you know, health disparities in terms of hypertension and diabetes and obesity, you know, lifestyle when you're growing up in terms of less access to health care, poverty, these sorts of things are contributing factors to the increased risk of Alzheimer's in African Americans.
Is there a link between obesity and Alzheimer's?
There's some research that's beginning to look at that and to show that there might be some things, but conclusively, not there yet.
877-217-5757 or 297-5633 for Dr. Robert Newton. 17 years at the Pennington Biomedical Research Center. His research interests center on addressing health disparities in African-American adults and children. And as noted, African Americans are more prone to obesity and diabetes. And in Louisiana, the numbers for white people are much higher than they are on the national level as well. It seems we have a problem in this state, probably throughout the South, with poor lifestyle choices.
That's true. So we know that we don't get enough physical activity. Adults are supposed to get 30 minutes a day of moderate to vigorous physical activity. They're not getting that. Children are supposed to be getting an hour a day. And we know that as children grow older, they do less and less physical activity, especially in girls. And then, of course, there's dietary habits in terms of eating too much fat and not enough fruits and vegetables. Those sorts of things are putting people at risk for developing a number of different conditions.
And unlike 50 years ago, we now in some cases encourage people to be overweight. I don't want to be flip, but we had this gentleman, Seth Davidovich, who wrote a book called Everyone Lies or Everybody Lies. And in his book, he says the most prominent operation in America right now is implants in the backside. Can you believe that? People want to look healthy, as we say.
There is an ideal body image that many people try to strive for, and sometimes that has some deleterious consequences.
So how do we get past that? How do we encourage people to be fit, even if the new norm is to be robust?
So I think that we have to make it a lifestyle. We have to make it part of our culture to be more physically active and to eat healthier. And that's tough. We have to change our environment. Okay, you have to make it easier for people to be physically active. You have to give them safe places to walk in streets that are without crooked sidewalks and things of this nature. And you have to provide healthy foods at a price that everybody can afford. And you have to have restaurants and grocery stores who are promoting healthy eating. And so that's really a culture change, and that's something that's going to take a lot of time. There are places in the United States, excuse me, that are healthier. You know, you go to places like Salt Lake City, places in Colorado where they've kind of structured their environments to be more healthy, and so they have less prevalence of these chronic diseases and things. So it can be done. It just takes concerted effort from the top down.
877-217-5757 for Dr. Robert Newton, who, by the way, practices what he preaches. You are a lean man. You don't get that by osmosis, I don't think.
No, I don't.
You work at it. What do you
do?
Yeah,
so I do my best to practice what I preach. So I've always been physically active, played soccer growing up, ran track, and I play a lot of tennis. And I try to eat healthy, so lots of fruits and vegetables, not a whole lot of fat, not a whole lot of carbs.
Well, I mean, he is really in good shape, but you're probably approaching 50?
45.
Okay, well, that's at an age where the wheels start falling off the wagon for a lot of men in particular. So you think you're going to be able to keep this up?
That's my plan, yeah. I think that as long as I don't overdo it and take care of injuries when they come about, and continue to try to eat the way that I'm supposed to, then, yeah, I think I'll be able to maintain it for a lifestyle.
Ellen in Sherwood. Hi, Ellen. You're on Talk Louisiana with Dr. Robert Newton of the Pennington Biomedical Research Center.
Hi, Dr. Newton. I'm a health coach, and I have seen many studies that show that obesity and diabetes are definitely risk factors for developing Alzheimer's. You've probably seen those studies. And also, you mentioned you shouldn't eat much fat. That's a fallacy. The right kind of fat, coconut oil, is actually very healthy and good for the body, and MCT oil. And those are excellent treatments for Alzheimer's. I wonder if you've studied them as well.
So in response to your statements. So I don't propose, and I don't think that I said this, that you should eat no fat. I think you should reduce the amount of fat that you eat. And you're right, there are certain fats that are better for you than others. That's very true. But we don't want our diet to be 50% fat, even if it is the healthier fats. There are some studies that are showing that obesity is related to Alzheimer's disease. And there's a lot of studies that show a lot of things that are associated with Alzheimer's disease. And so we have to be careful to make sure that we're reading the most scientifically sound studies to draw these conclusions. And I'm not saying that the studies that you are reporting are not scientifically sound. I'm just saying that there's a lot of information out there.
Now, we have a big increase in Alzheimer's. At least that's the perception. Is it because we're living longer? Or is it because perhaps something is happening that we're doing to ourselves or some environmental thing that is causing this to increase?
It's a multitude of factors. I think that, yes, because people are living longer, you're starting to see higher levels of Alzheimer's, and I think that there's lifestyle factors that are contributing to it as well.
Now, this is related to our opening discussion. A listener notes that a lot of thin people have Alzheimer's. There's never a universal survey. There's always going to be an outlier.
No, it's not. So if you're overweight, you may have a higher risk of having Alzheimer's or some other dementia, because remember that Alzheimer's is just one of many dementias.
Well, for those young people who say, I sure don't want to get Alzheimer's, maybe they've had a loved one who's been afflicted, and it is an awful situation, particularly for the people around the person who mm-hmm. is afflicted with it. What would you suggest as a way to thwart this long term?
I think everybody needs to realize that, you know, you can't prevent everything. Like, it's just not possible. But if you want to reduce your risk of Alzheimer's, I would suggest living a healthy lifestyle, getting enough physical activity, eating right, sleeping mm-hmm. properly, you know, stress management, going to your doctor, getting regular health checkups. I mean, there's a multitude of things that you can do. It doesn't mean that you're going to completely prevent it, because there are certain things that are out of our control, genetics being one of them, to some extent. And so, you know, you just have to do your best to live a healthy lifestyle.
This study, is it available for people to participate in?
Yes, it is. We're recruiting right now. We're looking to get 56 African-American individuals between the ages of 65 and 85 into the study. All they need to really do is they can call Pennington at 225-763-3000, or they can go onto our website, www.pbrc.edu/PACE, P-A-A-C-E, to learn more about the study. The study is, you know, people will come in, we'll essentially screen mm-hmm. them, then they will participate in one of two groups for 12 weeks, and then we will do some outcome assessments at the end. These assessments include things like blood pressure. We're going to do a blood draw so we can see how things have changed with your blood levels. We're going to assess your thinking, so your memory and your processing speed and executive mm-hmm. function, how you're thinking, essentially, both pre and post. And, you know, you either get into a program where you're exercising, or you're going to get into a program that's a social program. And then we'll see how things turn out at the end.
Now, quite often people will live into their 70s, maybe even in their 80s, and be overweight. But rarely do we see 90 and 100-year-old people who are obese. Eventually it catches up to people, doesn't it?
Obesity catching up to people?
Yes.
It doesn't always. You know, again, like you said, there's really no hard and fast rules. We can't say just because we're going to get older that we're going to get obesity, that we're going to, you know, get these things. You do increase your risk of developing things like Alzheimer's as you get older.
So, and diabetes.
Yeah.
And hypertension, mm-hmm. heart disease.
That's true, yeah.
The whole array of bad things. Cancer
yeah.
even has been related to obesity in some cases.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
So you're walking the walk and saying this on a daily basis, but as I stated, I think the American people, by and large, are fat and happy. And look at the people we elect to high office. Many of them are not the ideal of what would have been a half century ago, but now we view that as the norm, as an example to be followed.
Well, I do think that it's probably more prevalent than what it needs to be, certainly.
Well, once again, contact you for the study. What's the best way, doctor?
225-763-3000 or www.pbrc.edu/PACE, P-A-A-C-E.
Thank you, Dr. Robert Newton. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Your local dial, 297-5633. And it is talk at talklouisiana.org if you'd like to send us an email. Hopefully, we will be speaking in a moment or two with Catherine Gerbner. Her book is Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World. And it is a compelling book, and one that, of course, is quite provocative, and hopefully we'll make contact with this fine historian from the University of Minnesota. And a reminder that tomorrow one of our guests will be A.G. Crow, an array of candidates running for Secretary of State, and he is one, and hopefully we'll talk to all of them. Rick Edmonds, the state lawmaker, will also be with us on Wednesday, and the surprise was Friday, right before the end of qualifying, Kyle Ardoin, the interim Secretary of State, who lost a Louisiana House race many years ago, 11 years ago, to Steve Carter, I think by 87 votes. He's in the race now. He's running to keep the job that he has, and we'll see what happens, and we'll hopefully have this as a meeting place for the candidates. 877-217-5757. And as mentioned, our guest is the fine historian Catherine Gerbner, who teaches history at the University of Minnesota. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, it is an honor and pleasure to speak with you. And Christian slavery is a work of history, and it is one, as I stated, it's an uncomfortable topic for many people. Tell us why this legacy is not so pleasant for those of us who are Christians. It is an unfortunate part of the past that in many cases the church condoned slavery. What was going on back in the day?
Yes, it's true. I mean, often when we think of Christianity and we think of slavery, we want to think about the Christian abolitionists who played such a really important role in combating and eventually defeating slavery. But the fact is that Christianity and Christians played a really important role in creating slavery in the Americas and justifying slavery in the Americas. So my research looks at this history. It's an uncomfortable history, as you said. And it looks at the many different roles that religion is, and specifically Christianity, Protestant Christianity, played in initially justifying slavery and then in developing sort of a new concept of race that would replace religious difference as a new justification for slavery.
You say Protestant leaders were more prominent than Catholic ones?
Well, so, yes, in the English colonies that eventually became, you know, the United States and many of the Caribbean nations, these were Protestant governments. And so initially, Protestants justified slavery by saying, well, we won't enslave fellow Christians, but we can enslave heathens, especially in a quote-unquote just war. And so this was one of the initial underlying justification for enslaving Africans and forcibly transporting them to the Americas. Now, once they got to the Americas and these were sort of quote-unquote heathen slaves with Protestant slave-owning masters, then slave owners, because they felt that it was Protestantism was connected to their freedom, they didn't want enslaved people to convert to Christianity, and they didn't allow them to access baptism. And so that was one way that religion sort of was underlying the initial creation of slavery in the Americas. Eventually, Protestant missionaries arrived, and you know they found this abhorrent that enslaved people weren't able to become Christians. They thought that they should be able to have this have access to Christianity. And in fact, many enslaved people recognized that Christianity was this important. I mean, it was part of the way that you could vote or hold office or have political power. It's how you could learn how to read. So there were many reasons that enslaved people also sort of fought for their right to become Christians. And over time, they were a small but sort of significant number of enslaved men and women were able to fight their way into churches. And at this point, this is when we see the creation of a new justification for slavery, so one that is based on race. Instead of on religion. And so, the word white, the idea that there are white people, this is actually created at this time as a new way to justify slavery.
The book is Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World from Professor Catherine Gerbner. And were certain biblical passages used to justify slavery?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there's always... They're always a little bit contorted in the interpretations because, of course, there is no race and there is no sort of real justification for slavery in the Bible. But certainly pro-slavery Christians pointed to, well, there in the Old Testament there are cases of slavery. And then the curse of Ham became probably one of the central justifications for enslaving people. And, you know, again, there are a lot of sort of logical contortions here, because Noah curses Ham's son Canaan as to be a servant unto the descendants of his brothers. And so pro-slavery Christians then said, okay, well then, you know, Canaan must have traveled to Africa, and all Africans must be descended from Canaan, and therefore they are destined to be slaves. And that is our justification for slavery. You know, of course, there's no, that Africa is not mentioned in that story, but that was used, and it was a very powerful way to convince people that what basically what they were doing was okay.
877-217-5757 is your number for Professor Gerbner, and we go to David in Atlanta. David, you're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. There was a renowned segregationist in New Orleans during the days of school integration, Mrs. Gilliatt, who was excommunicated by Archbishop Cody for her stance against integration. And she would cite John chapter 14, verses 2 and 3, regarding Jesus saying, "My Father's house has many rooms." That was her argument to keep the schools segregated. I'd like to know, what is your guest opinion of that, I think, preposterous remark?
All right. Professor Gerbner, your thoughts? Your thoughts about the house of the Lord having many places.
I would agree with the caller that it is, I think he used the word preposterous. You know, again, the sort of the legal or the rational contortions that some people use to justify what is, frankly, an unjust practice, you know, it's just, it knows no bounds. And I would agree that, you know, there are many ways to interpret many of these passages, but certainly a defense of segregation, a defense of slavery. I mean, I would see those as part of the same kind of unfortunate strain of Christian thought that can tend to be, you know, unjust. And there are many different ways to interpret these passages that I think are truer to, you know, the sense of the Bible and the sense of the Scripture.
Jim, thank you, David. Jim on O'Neill Lane, you're on with Dr. Gerbner. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Christians have been very good at contorting Scripture to get away with all sorts of abhorrent behavior. They're doing it again now when it comes to LGBT. I mean, this is sadly nothing new.
Dr. Gerbner? Is that analogous to slavery?
You know, so I think that it is true that again, you know, the words of the Bible can be used in many different ways and contorted into justify many different practices and to condemn many different practices. And you know, I agree that I agree with the caller that it can be contorted in ways that. I mean, I truly definitely also don't agree with, in terms of, the longer history of slavery and Christianity. I mean, it's a uncomfortable truth, but one that I think that we can learn from because, you know, the missionaries who were trying to convince Protestant slave owners to allow their slaves to become Christian, right, they thought of themselves as being really reformers and radicals, and they thought that they were doing the right thing. In the process, they managed to create a whole network of arguments for the justification of slavery through a Christian lens. And so what I think we can learn from this history is that, you know, we have to be really careful about how we're using Scripture, what we think that we're doing when we think we're being, you know, quote-unquote righteous, and to take a broader view, to think of other perspectives, and to recognize that, you know, it's difficult to do the right thing.
The book is Christian Slavery, Conversion and Race in the Protestant Atlantic World from Professor Catherine Gerbner. And in a Washington Post piece that she wrote several weeks ago, Professor Gerbner said, "Most people think whiteness is innate. They're wrong. It was created to keep black people from voting. When slaves got close to voting rights, slave owners changed the rules of the game." So It is a fascinating book that has relevance today, and it seems we continue to fight this battle one way or the other involving race in America, and in our state we know it to be a prominent point of discussion. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Becca Dill, I'm Jim Inkster. We're glad you're listening to WRKF, and thanks for listening to Talk Louisiana. And stay tuned.